I'd like to thank you all for coming to session 208, Kids These Days, K through 12 Students and the Use of Primary Sources. The reason why we propose this panel is because we think that to a great degree the K through 12 audience is not being targeted by archival institutions as often as it should be. We feel that the children of today are the archives users of tomorrow, the donors of tomorrow. If you want to be perfectly pragmatic, the taxpayers of tomorrow. So making them aware of the important resources that archives have to offer is vital for our continued relevance as informational institutions. You look at the struggle libraries are having, bringing in younger users and, you know, incorporating people into what they do. We feel that archives are kind of facing the same challenge, and that a lot of that can be alleviated by working more closely with K through 12 students. So the presenters of this panel are involved with exciting and innovative projects related to the use of archival primary resources by K through 12 students. And by developing and carrying out these projects, the panelists are connecting with an important and often overlooked demographic and are providing K through 12 students with an opportunity to learn and work with archival resources. I'm hopeful that this session and the discussion to follow, and we'll have plenty of time for discussion. So if you want to kind of think of questions as we go along, I will definitely be able to address those at the end. We'll provide you with ideas for projects working with K through 12 students and the motivation and ambition to develop them. I'll begin by introducing our panelists. The first speaker is Matt Urbison, who is the reference and outreach archivist at the Legacy Center of Drexel University College of Medicine in Philadelphia. Next, we have Deirdre A. Skaggs, who is the Associate Dean for Special Collections at the University of Kentucky Libraries. Following that, we have Greg Koken, who is the Special Collections Librarian and University Archivist for the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. And then following Greg, we have Gwen Grenadous, who is the Director of Archival Operations at the National Archives in Riverside. And speaking with Glenn is Chuck Leibolt, who is a high school teacher at JW North High School in Riverside, California. So without further ado, we'll bring Matt up here and start the panelists.
Okay. Having watched us successfully get everything off flash drives, let's see if PowerPoint will actually open. Okay. So my name is Matt Herbison. I'm here from the Drexel Med School Archives in Philadelphia. And I'm going to talk to you today about connecting your collections with the K through 12 audience and doing it in an online setting in particular. This audience is new to our archives. We've only been working with it for the last couple of years, and it'll come as no surprise that when you deal with primary sources and K through 12 audience, they tend to like it maybe a little bit more than remembering names and dates and looking through textbooks. It's a little more engaging. So when we've talked with these students, we have some feedback from them, and it's been really gratifying. So here's what students have been saying, and here's what we hope it means. I felt like a detective. Okay, so what that is saying is that they're able to starting to be able to critically think about documents. Look at two documents. Do they agree? Do they disagree? How do you work with those materials to put a story together or to gather evidence? The old photo was more real. They don't have the photography. They don't have the vocabulary yet. So what they're kind of getting a sense of is authenticity and originalness. I got angry. Okay, this is really crucial. Not that they have to get angry, but if they are getting angry about primary sources, you can't ask for a better thing. It means that they're personally engaged and excited about what they're seeing. Okay, so students need this, and teachers need this too. So this is my sort of sloppy West Coast haiku. It's 18 syllables. It's a little relaxed. Doing history is more than historical thinking. It's really all about critical thinking. And everything that all of us, if I can be very presumptuous, are going to be talking about today is going towards getting students to think critically using evidence to support a viewpoint. Now, not to, you know, if the Archivist of the United States wants to snoop through my slides and steal my ideas for his plenary talk, that's okay. But we can indeed learn from museums and other groups. museum educators, this K through 12 audience is their bread and butter. K through 12 museum educators every day are dealing with this audience. And why aren't we doing this too? What we're talking about with the project that I'll be presenting is about interpretation. And this is interpretation in the museum sense of the word, which is taking a collection of resources, whether they're artifacts or archives, and supporting a viewpoint through those artifacts, or in our case, archives. You walk into an exhibit gallery, you're presented with objects and a viewpoint. Okay, putting the story together using those raw materials is what we're dealing with. So what we're doing at the Drexel University Med School Archives is we've been asking the question for the last couple years, how do we connect with this K through 12 audience, but how do we do it in an online setting? So we have recently finished a planning grant, and we're just starting our implementation grant, and we got funding from this Heritage Philadelphia program. Now, the reason I mention this is, of course, to thank them for their funding, but also because it does go towards being creative about looking for funding sources. This is a funder in Philadelphia that mostly funds museum-y, interpretive-y, exhibit-y type projects. And that's what we've done. We've presented them with this, and it seems novel when an archives comes and does present such an idea. So over the last year and a half, roughly, we've worked with groups of students to try out different stories in class and give them students and teachers, give them surveys, and work with focus groups. Okay, so where are we starting from? We have a custom-grown digital collection system. We've had it for 7 or 8 years, got grant funding for that. And it works really well for our typical researchers. Most of us who've developed digital collections websites, this is to serve the needs of our typical group of researchers. And you always end up reaching new people, but it's to save people from having to come in and do the research on site. But what we found with our digital collection site is the interface fails. It's not up to the task. It's getting old, but one way or the other. It doesn't have features that they need, and our metadata is completely insufficient for this audience. It's not going to, it doesn't give them what they need. So let's see what we, I can show you some example of that. So we all work with primary sources every day. We have a pretty good sense of how they work. Imagine that you're in ninth grade. Okay. I now know nothing about primary sources. Eliza and Matilda are going to be the example that I'm working with throughout this presentation. So Eliza Greer and Matilda Evans, they're two women, African-American women, graduated from a med school in 1897. So not very common in 1897 for women to graduate from a med school, let alone African-American women. Okay, so Eliza and Matilda are the two people that we're dealing with. This is a little small, here in the back, but this is a page from our current digital collection site. So let's go through this. Again, we're in ninth grade. Ugly, small. I don't know who either of those people are, Eliza Greer, Susan B. Anthony. There she is again. Okay, Greer graduated from Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania in 1897. I don't know. Who's Greer? I still don't know. Oh, it's 19 centimeters by 12 centimeters. Now I get it. Okay, and the subject. Okay, this is actually where it's starting to look a little bit interesting. So we have African-American women in professions and women physicians. If I'm the type of student who has any interest, might have any interest in this, there might be something there to go with. So the upshot of this is that what we found is that archives, online collections are too hard for teachers and students to use. And it's not only ours, it's probably yours too. They need to be more accessible, more useful, and more engaging. These are requirements that you need to connect with this K through 12 audience. So what we found from our conversations and surveys and things are that students and teachers want this type of features, or they want these things that are after the bullet points. They want context. We all want context. But when they look at, if they Google and find your page, they want to know, why should I care about this? Why does this matter to me? They're teenagers. Why blank me is the question structure for that audience. Anytime that you can provide video or audio, they're going to appreciate it. Transcripts, even for typescripts that are scanned in, they want to be able to copy out of a page and paste it into the project that they're working on. It doesn't matter how easy the TypeScript is to read. Same applies to images. They want to be able to grab it, put it in a PowerPoint, put it in a Prezi, put it in a movie that they're making. You want a good balance of images and text, and this is where it comes back to the museum mindset. You don't want to walk in to an exhibit gallery and see that it's all text and there's like one image over here. So depending on how heavy the text is, you might want to balance it with a couple images or a whole bunch of images. And what we heard numerous times from teachers is that what they do is they find these lesson plans that are online, they download them and pull them apart to use the context and a couple, you know, images or documents that are mentioned in the lesson plan. And you say, I'll use this one, I'll use this one, what is this about? Oh, okay, now I can integrate this into my lesson plan, into my classroom. So should we be presenting things that are sort of more a la carte? Okay, so what we're developing at the Drexel Med School Archives is what we're calling the Digital History Toolkit. So this, again, is based on our findings. It's an interpretive layer on top of a revamped digital collections database, and it's driven by stories. There's also improved item-level pages, which I'll show you in a second. So this is a mock-up of the Digital History Toolkit, the story-level page. So let's walk through here compared to what we walked through with that other digital collections page. Eliza Greer and Matilda Evans, Two Women, Two Paths. That's very much an exhibit title, okay? It's a call, well, and this next part especially is a call to explore this story. The next thing is a brief contextualizing paragraph. The thing on the left is actually like a 30, 45-second video, voiceover, Ken Burnsy images floating around, something that we can make in-house. Here's the collection of documents that support this story. If you look at that first document, it's you can map it on a map or map it on a timeline, see where it falls geographically and time-wise. And then there's some questions to consider. Very general question that applies to any document. What do you know from reading this? What do you wish you knew from after reading this? So let's imagine that we click on this first document. We're not taken to a whole item level page where you see the whole thing and there's information on the side. It's a detail with a transcription. There are a great many forces operating against the sources of the Negro in business. Okay, so this, we struggled with this a little bit. Are we giving them too much? This is a novice user group. They're still going to have to put the story together, even if you give them a little more than maybe you wish you gave them. More context, an audio version of the transcript, a link to the full document, able to map this on a map or on a timeline. This is the item level record. Okay, so this is the other thing that I showed you earlier. Here's the background. Eliza Greer, an emancipated slave, graduated from Women's Medical College in 1897. That's the short background. Then we go into why it matters. It's right here on the item level page. This item connects with one or more stories, the Eliza Greer and Matilda Evans story, for example, but it might also connect to other stories. So if someone stumbles upon this item level page, they might be taken over to one of the stories. Transcript. We're going to also have a topical in to the website, where it's African American experience, Civil War, World War II, that kind of thing. Okay, this is the second tab available, which is the standard metadata that you'd be used to seeing. It's not the first thing that the users see, but it's available there. So to sum up, the Digital History Toolkit, interpretive layer on top of this digital collections database, improved item level pages, context to help users answer why does this matter, why should I care, it's easy to grab images and text. It all relies on the story-based pages, which gather together multiple documents, put them in context, connect them to each other. Placed in time and geographically, and it prompts them to explore the documents and figure out the connections between the documents to provide evidence for a story. Later phases of the development will add more options for guided discovery, more interactive features. So, whether or not you're doing this, whether or not you're doing this online, whether or not you have no money or some money, this is something you should be doing. And all it really takes is a story, the documents that support that story, historical context, and the connection with the teacher actually go hand in hand. Once you find a teacher who wants to use primary sources, they're going to tell you how they want to use it in their classroom. That's going to help you figure out which documents, which context you need to help them along. So if you are interested in this audience, first of all, you should come to the RAO, the Reference Access and Outreach section meeting, today at 3:30, so right after this, Sapphire 400. And in particular, join us with the Teaching with Primary Sources discussion group. There's other groups there too, but since I'm standing up here, I'll say it's the best one, the TPS discussion group. Sorry. There's a Midwest Archives Conference Symposium coming up in October, which is going to be really great, a day and a half of packed full of programming, Archives 101 for teachers, Teaching 101 for archivists, you know, lesson plan development. And then tomorrow at 10 o'clock, there's also a really cool session, one of which the NARA Philly branch person from there is talking about a project where social studies teachers, before they go into the classroom, are sent to do field experiences and get experience with primary sources. You can become a social studies teacher and not have any exposure to primary sources. That's the standard practice these days. Okay, so there I am. Ooh, special bonus slides. Okay, so thank you.
So, as I was introduced, my name is Deirdre. See if I can even talk and try and do this at the same time. It is the opposite. Fantastic. So, what I am going to give you today is just a little case study of my experience working with K-12 and primary sources. So, in the fall of 2012, I approached a really good friend of mine who happens to be a literacy coach at the Lexington School for the Creative and Performing Arts, and I wanted her to collaborate with me on a project using primary sources in her classroom. So we were just casually discussing it, and it ended up being an exciting project for both of us and also for her sixth graders that we tested it out on. I wouldn't be standing here today if I didn't believe strongly in utilizing primary sources in active learning exercises, and it's really critical to my mission as Associate Dean of Special Collections at the University of Kentucky Libraries. So in my opinion, while we must continue to tend to the basics of our archival needs, it's time to reach out proactively into our communities, perhaps more now than ever. Most of the focus at this point at UK's Special Collections has been outreach to undergraduate and graduate faculty members and their students. You know, we often have tours of our Special Collections for close K-12 schools. We've had very few significant or meaningful interactions with them. And so because of my passion for it, as Matt said, you know, we are creating the next generation of researchers, and I wanted to take a chance on a new opportunity because I had the in with my friend who teaches at SCAPA. And anyways, I naively think that archives are fun and obviously meaningful, and just figured that all those sixth graders would think so too. And so that's what I went out to test. So after our initial conversation, we collaborated on what the goals of the archival exercise would be, and this was predominantly governed by the standards in place in the Fayette County Public School System in the state of Kentucky. So what we came up with, that the goal was to improve the students' understanding of primary sources, including predominantly analysis of imagery, and creating appropriate questions to guide research, and then conducting meaningful research after. Her approach was to achieve these goals was through in-class work, exercises, and through actively viewing the primary sources. They had a final project with this experience, and it was a reflective piece. They were asked to create something that represented what they learned in a creative way. Since the school focuses on creative arts, the students were given a very open-ended project where they were encouraged to do anything they wanted, whether it was perform, make a video, write a piece of music, or anything else that their imagination would allow. So our next step was to select the actual primary sources that the students would work with. I threw out some very basic suggestions on material that we had in the archives, and we weren't doing it based on particular subject matter, so it was really open and there was a lot of freedom. The class itself was a sixth grade elective called Read, Write, Math, so it was also a very open class. And I had this idea that as a sixth grader, if I was a sixth grader, that I would be intrigued by documents that I could connect with. And so my way to do this with them was to try and connect them to place, specifically the place where they go to school, at least initially. We branched out. So I selected a group of aerial photographs from the 1950s of the neighborhood where their school was located. The neighborhood surrounding their school was just forming. The now defunct mall was still a farm, and their school was not yet built. There were some markers, though. That image right there is the Lafayette High School, which is right next door to their school still. The next set of documents were images of women workers on strike, and these were women who worked at a GE plant for higher wages post-World War II. The GE plant was also located in close proximity to their school. So I did want to introduce some other documents that I felt like might be a little more challenging and weren't just visual. So we had a slave emancipation record, a letter written by Mary Todd Lincoln, and a suffragette flyer. So after that, we had the great opportunity to discuss the pedagogical approach to introducing the materials to the sixth graders. And we talked about this quite a bit, and what we finally decided was to go against what we both thought we should do and not have me come in and talk to them about archives at all. Well, first, anyway. So that I wouldn't come and talk about where the documents came from, not what they were of, who was in them, when, why, or how. That I would do that, but I wouldn't do it until after they'd engaged with the materials. And I think that they weren't bored right off the bat. They got to do their own exploration and discovery with those materials. We did utilize the Library of Congress's worksheets on analyzing primary sources. And for the class exercises, I was not present for any of them. But this is essentially how it went. The instructor showed photos of the women's strike first. They were split up in small groups and different pictures to different groups. And after reviewing, the students filled out the primary analysis evaluation tool. They would write down what they saw in detail, write down questions for further study. And they also came up with some hypotheses for what they thought might be happening in the particular image. Then the students would share out with the entire class their picture, since they all had different ones. And because each picture provided a little bit more information or a different set of information, they were able to make connections about what was going on in the photographs. And so with this new information, they formulated group questions for their self-guided research. So that's what they did next. They were asked to research what they were looking at, and they were given a little bit more information with this. They had lots of theories about the photographs, so they were told the time frame. They were asked why women might want to strike for equal pay or equal rights. One of their theories was that they were striking to be able to wear blue jeans. So they had a lot of fun speculating and then finding out what really was going on. And so as they were doing this research, they immediately came across images of Rosie the Riveter, and they didn't get that at all. So with a little more guidance, they started reading about post-World War II striking for women. They found an article that they shared with the class, and then their instructor helped them understand what Rosie the Riveter represented. So it was only at this point that the students found out that the GE plant that this was taking place was at the end of their street, essentially. And so for the next group exercise, they went to the plant and walked around the plant and talked more about it and took the photographs with them. I should say that we made facsimiles of all the items, and they were laminated. So they looked really nice, but they could really just mess with them and with no worry about damaging them. And so that really reinforced their connection to that place. They were really interested that they had gone past this GE plant, you know, most of them nearly every day, and had no idea what had gone on there before. So they were really, really into that. So the next group exercise, which was very similar, the instructor used the aerial photographs of the neighborhood and used the analysis tool again. So again, they had no idea what the images were of necessarily, when they were taken. And they went through the same steps, but they didn't do the research at this point. So again, they walked down to the front of the neighboring high school because they had figured it out. I mean, it was pretty obvious with the big landmark of the high school. So they figured that out pretty quickly. But they walked down to the high school with the photographs and started just comparing everything that they saw, you know, whether or not trees were gone, if trees were bigger, what houses were there and what houses weren't, and really compared how much the area had changed. And so in this exercise, they became obsessed with how the photographs were actually taken. They were really interested in the mechanics of it and how film cameras worked and had all sorts of questions that I would have never anticipated them having. So they went through the remaining documents, still using the analysis tool, still working in small groups with discussion, and then talked about primary sources in general, now that they had been experienced with visual materials, a letter, a document, and a piece of ephemera. And so it was at this point that they were given their final project, which, as I said, was completely wide open. Create something that makes a meaningful statement about your place in Lexington and something that you think could be a part of the history of your hometown. They had to make sure that it included something about what they learned through the project, and also it could have been connected to the importance of art, the importance of knowing history, the importance of women's studies, pretty much whatever they wanted. So after this final project was introduced, then I was invited to come to the classroom. And they brainstormed as a group the kinds of questions that they were going to ask me. And so when I got there, they were so excited to ask me questions that I was completely blown away. They wanted to know, like, walking into that room was like walking into any sort of lecture that you dream about the questions that they're going to ask you, but they actually ask you, and they're really excited. So they wanted to know how we got our collections, what we did once we got them, if the collection was skewed because it was dependent on people thinking their materials were important. They wanted to know what my typical day was like. They wanted to know how I became an archivist, what made me want to be an archivist, what sort of education I had. They wanted to talk about local history and how the things that they were doing in their lives were going to become part of future history. They were so engaged, and it worked magic on me. So, and they also, they wanted to know, they asked me about the film cameras, they asked me about the aerial photographs. They were so excited that they didn't want me to go, which was really great. So to contextualize my romanticism a little bit, I'll say that in addition to what I do as associate dean, I often take on overloads to teach. And so I've taught more than 25, at least, college-level courses for credit, tours all the time. I've led exercises in the archives and provided numerous guest lectures. But there was something about that group of students that surpassed all of those experiences. So they offered to skip their next class to stay and talk about archives with me. And then ultimately, because they couldn't, they begged me to come back. So I said that I would come back and I would look at their final projects. So they had about 2.5 weeks with guidance from their instructor to work on their final projects. And so among the things that they produced, someone wrote a violin piece about the importance of history and memory and performed it with a video. One student spoke about what the world would be like without art. There was a video of one student's personal place in the history of Lexington, a skit where several students recreated the strike at the GE plant. One group created a photo album with memories and sold them to the entire class and then donated the proceeds to their capital campaign. One group created a time capsule with really thoughtful items in it to be opened in 75 years, and then a skit about knowing the importance of Kentucky history. So at the end of that class period, they were still, if not more, excited about the experience than they were before. They were really interested in knowing what I thought about their interpretations. They wanted to know if they could place them in the archives so that people could understand their perspective. They gave me hugs. They asked me to come back again. And so I think that the project was a great success, and I found it very rewarding, as did their instructor. They got to see historic primary documents and make their own connections to the present and the future. And the students walked away from the project with increased critical thinking skills a heightened sense of place and time, and an appreciation for the connection of the past to present to future. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Let's adjust this. They don't make podiums for people of my height, so I think that will work. I usually don't like the microphone. If I had it my way, I'd be right down there with you. All right. Well, in order to try to connect with what my colleagues have already said, I'm probably going to throw out kind of a big chunk of my introduction here. All I really want to state is that the audience of who uses archives is changing. The people that we saw using archives in the 1970s, the 80s, the 90s, even into the 2000s, it doesn't look anything like the audience that we are looking at today. And I think the K through 12 student group is definitely one of those audiences that archivists are really starting to connect with. And one of the easiest ways that we as archivists can connect with that group is through National History Day. It's an opportunity just waiting for us to get involved. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with National History Day, it's a competition for middle and high school students to develop a historical topic based upon a theme and then research that, original research, and present it in a variety of formats and then compete at regional, state, and national competitions for awards and scholarships. And in order to participate with National History, to do that, students have to not only look at secondary sources, but they have to look at primary sources. And who better to help students connect with primary sources than archivists? All right, so in my exploration of this topic, I'm going to discuss it a little bit from my perspective as an archivist at a small regional archive. And as my overview slide states here, I'm going to discuss why the issue matters, how you as archivists can get involved, some tips and strategies which I have learned along the way, and a little bit more about NHD and Archives Toolkit, a resource that was created to help archivists get involved. So I want to start with a question. Why should we care about the K through 12 student group? I could tell you about how our nation's K through 12 students perform poorly, according to standardized tests, in the area of American history. I could go on and tell you about how students who participate in National History Day outperform their peers, not just in history, but in all subject areas across the board. I could also tell you about how, as archivists, we must consider ourselves as educators, and how in that capacity, as an educator, we should strive to connect with the K through 12 audience. I could tell you about that recent article from Norm Augustin about how greater historical literacy is not just something our students need, it's something our economy needs today. I could tell you about the joy of connecting with the K through 12 audience and watching as their curious minds explore and learn about history through primary sources. But ultimately, I bet you a lot of you here today could come up to this podium and tell us all of those same things about how exciting and how fun it is to be able to connect with those K through 12 students. And no matter how much I tell you about how fun it is to work with those students, how invigorating it can be for you as an archivist to connect with a different audience like that, it may not mean much. You may go back and in the flurry of day-to-day activities, forget a lot about what you've learned here today. So besides it simply being a fun experience or feeling positive about those contributions you make, there needs to be a tangible reason to consider connecting with the K through 12 audience. So here it is. It builds friends. It builds supports. It creates a vibrant program which no longer serves your community, but then actually becomes part of the community. In time, those friends, that support, it will strengthen the program in the eyes of resource providers and perhaps even improve your bottom line down the road. So, some basic tips. Working with K through 12 students can be challenging and rewarding. Here are some basic things that I've encountered along the way. First, K through 12 students are generally unfamiliar with both primary sources and the concept of archives. As an archivist, you need to take this into consideration and carefully explain these concepts to K through 12 students. Do not expect them to be able to dive into research without first understanding and becoming comfortable with the archives environment. Secondly, we need to remember that those students are in the process of developing research skills. They're not seasoned archival researchers, and you have to be patient when you work with them. Keep instructional sessions for very large groups focused. It's especially important if it's that group's first time visiting an archive. And some may disagree with this, but I say avoid show and tell. In my opinion, we have a tendency to showcase the greatest and most valuable pieces in our collections. While this may work well with donors, it could leave students with the wrong impression about archives. While we are closely associated with museums, we ultimately want students to understand archives as something related, but at the same time distinctly different from museums. We are a research environment. We welcome you to look at our primary sources and learn from them. Next, keep it local, something the last presenter really touched upon. Regional archives, of course, specialize in this. Students may be very unfamiliar with local history, and helping them explore collections of a local nature can have a very positive, lasting impact on those students. Harness their curiosity, but be aware of their attention span. If archives and primary sources is something new to students, they're going to be curious and engaged. But in order to maintain that engagement, you need to help the students identify collections which are appropriate for their age level and match the skills they bring to the table. For example, 19th century handwriting is a challenge for any researcher. But for a K through 12 student, it's just going to lead to frustration, and it could possibly lead them to completely lose interest in where you're going. And then lastly, you have to develop different tactics for different age groups. I work a lot with the K through 5 audience. For them, it's not about text, it's about images, photographs, and maps, something that they can understand quickly, and then you can make those connections with them. So how do you get started? Well, you start small and you build from there. The 2013 theme for National History Day is Turning Points in History: People, Ideas, Events. Those themes are broad and they allow students to be creative when exploring history in connection with that theme. Now, as a disclaimer, you don't need to focus on NHD when you want to get started working with the K through 12 audience. It just happens to be an opportunity waiting for us to open the door to and respond with. All right, some concrete ideas about how you can get started. First, become a National History Day judge. It's a great way to learn firsthand about National History Day and discover how, as an archivist, you can make an even greater impact. Furthermore, being a judge is a great way to learn about the teachers, the schools, and the NHD coordinators that make that program a success. Think of developing research guides or resource guides built around that National History Day theme, and then distribute it to teachers and schools. I can actually say that I did the very same thing last year and found out that an area school district was really active with National History Day, knew nothing about the archives, and I was able to make a great connection and bring those students in and help them to understand the archives, and it opened up a whole new world to those students. Reach out to local teachers and schools. Students can benefit about learning from primary sources from an expert. And that brings me to an auxiliary point, which I've already made, but I'm going to stress again. As archivists, we are also educators, and we must understand that. And then lastly, which is going to bring me into my next slides, the real heart of my presentation, visit the NHD toolkit created by the Society of American Archivists Reference, Access, and Outreach Section's National History Day Working Group. And you can see the web address there. This toolkit's development emerged out of the desire from RAO section archivists to learn more about National History Day and discover more information about how to engage with that program. The NHD and Archives Toolkit is designed for archivists, librarians, and archives professionals, but it's also designed for students and teachers. The pages there help to carefully explain how students and how teachers can get involved and how archivists can get involved, giving you steps and ideas to help you along the way. So let's take a look. And for this group, I want to focus on those resources for archivists. There's a number of resource pages, and seven key pages there, that are really developed for archivists. We have, detailed information about how archives can participate with the National History Program, a list of do's and don'ts for archivists. I recommend looking at that, especially if this is like a first time trying to get those groups through the door. There's a time frame there, which maps out the National History Day schedule month by month. It's a way for you to understand what's happening, when, and what you as an archivist need to be doing to make the proper connections with that audience. There's also information about how to select appropriate collections for use with National History Day participants, examples from around the profession on what other repositories are doing, and then instructions covering classroom visits to help you understand that and get you through those programs. Each of those pages is packed with great information to help archivists make informed decisions about engaging with students and the National History Day program. I will, however, add that this toolkit's value goes way beyond National History Day. One of my favorite pages is actually found in the Students and Teachers section. That page provides information about online primary sources and then links to dozens of great online resources that are available. I know that one of the things I often struggle with when I work with undergraduate students especially is they all want to be using the online resources, even though I explain to them that, you know, most of archives still are in analog format, but they want to be online. And there's not always an easy place to point them. Well, go here and you'll find everything you want. And so a page like this actually identifies some of the major digital collections which are out there. And I've used it with undergraduates with great success as well. All right. Before I turn the discussion over, I want to close my statement here by encouraging everyone to take a look at the NHD and Archives Toolkit. It's a great resource, and you can find the toolkit online at nhdarchives.pbworks.com. As archives continue to build new audiences and expand their programs, K through 12 students should not be overlooked. Engaging with this audience is an exciting, worthwhile activity. Thank you.
Okay, this is the challenge of going after somebody that's tall to readjust. My name is Gwen Granados. I am the director of the National Archives at Riverside. We are actually in Paris, California, but only Californians know the difference. So we say National Archives at Riverside because it's easier to pick on a map than Paris, California. It's about an hour and a half northeast of here, out in the desert where it's like 108 degrees today. So I'm happy to be in San Diego. Just really quick, by a show of hands, how many of you are archives educators? How many of you are archivists, just working as archivists? Okay. My hand is in that second group. I am not an educator. My background is in public history and archives. And when I came to the National Archives, I came from the National Park Service, where we have this neat and tidy group called Interpretive Rangers, and they all have education backgrounds, and they come into the archives every now and again, and they would look at photographs, and they'd research histories, and they'd take it away, and they would make these great K-12 presentations, and we never saw any of that. We were facilitators for that. We were resource providers, but we were not involved in the actual construction of interpretive material for the Park Service. So when I came in 2004 to the National Archives, I was confronted, maybe that's not the right word, right? That's a confrontational word. I was exposed to a growing education department within the National Archives. And if any of you are familiar with the education initiatives that the National Archives has undertaken, it's been pretty phenomenal over the past 6-8 years. We have a very vibrant education staff across the National Archives,
and there's none of us in Riverside. It's just archivists. So what we have to do in Riverside is figure out how to be archivists and educators without having an educational background. So what I tell my genealogical researchers and what we've told ourselves is begin with what you know. So if you start with what you know, you have a good foundation for where you're going. We didn't have a background. There was nobody on staff with a background in education. We didn't go to training for how to provide access to K-12 researchers at that level where the teachers were, as there were other units in the National Archives that did that. So we started with what we knew, which is research. We understand research. We understand how to provide historians, social scientists, lawyers with materials to get to their end product. So that is really where we started. So I want to show you our methodology for providing access in one of our more prominent programs, which we call directed research, and it is exactly what it sounds like it is. But just to show you how, if you're not an educator, you can still provide access to K-12 students. Most of the students that we work with are junior high and above, generally National History Day students and high school students, and then we even use some of this for undergraduates as well. There we go. So as with any good information management staff person, we made a database. We love databases, but we decided that as archivists, every time we answer a reference question or provide resources to somebody who's writing an article or somebody who's doing a presentation, we learned a little bit more about our records every time we do that. And I'm sure all of you practicing archivists, as you're processing, as you're answering reference questions, you run across materials and you say, hey, that's really great. This really illustrates, you know, historical topic A, B, C, and we have this here in our repository. So without wanting to lose that, we set up this database structure so we could capture some of that information and then get that information to students in kind of a digestible way. So our database includes a description area where we give the historical background of the material in what really does simply replicate secondary research. We have our staff-only notes, which is very important when you're trying to pull materials that you know which box to pull, right? So we capture that there. And then we also leave little notes for ourselves because it's not always me doing the workshop. Sometimes it's one of the other archivists. So we'll have even folder titles in there, you know, direct them to this letter so that staff knows, no matter who it is, they can get the student to the material they need. The research summary works very much like a finding aid would. So in some cases, it'll provide the institution that the records are coming from a little bit about what that institution was doing and why they created these records in the first place. So we're really trying to replicate the finding aid in a very brief way for the student. And then, of course, we include some secondary research. If there's a book that we know of that has been published, we'll put that in there so students can continue to research. And then if you note on the top where it says target audience, we actually will select audiences that this topic will be good for so that we can then extract that information if we have, when we put together our National History Day flyer for the year, or if we have, when we used to have Teaching American History teachers in, we would use that for them, or then the K-12 as well. So just to show you very quickly some of the outputs from this database, this is our directed research topics list, and my colleague at the end of the table, Mr. Leibolt, will tell you a little bit more about how that's received from students. His group is one that we have given this directed research topics list to, and we produce one based on those different groups. So History Day, we produce one. K-12, we'll produce another one. They're often the same topics, but every now and again, there's topics that fit with one group better than the other. And so we'll send this out to teachers, and oftentimes they will have their students select a topic, and they'll let us know what that topic is, and then we'll have all the records pulled when the students come in to do research. So this is what a staff note looks like. This is for the Zoot Suit Riots. We do have quite a bit of naval intelligence from San Pedro on the Zoot Suit Riots in 1943. They're really, really great reports, and they are very unfiltered. So this is a very good way for students to engage with the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 1940s in the World War II era. So this, for example, has the box, the folder where these letters are. And not only does it help us pull, like I said, but as archivists, as we're working with the students as we're walking around the room, we can gently guide them towards the aha moment so that they don't necessarily have to slog through. They're doing original research. We pull the boxes. This is not facsimile. This is research. So they're in the original box. They're in the original folder, and they are going through one page at a time, mind you, each document as they're going doing regular research. And so we don't want them to get overwhelmed with the vast amount of material. And I will tell you, the Navy doesn't file things nicely. You would think they would, but they don't. So there's a lot of things, for example, in some of these folders that have nothing to do with the Zoot Suit Riots. And there are plenty of times when the students get hung up on the first document in the folder, and then they wonder what in the world this procurement of a Jeep has to do with the Zoot Suit Riots. So we have some notes to kind of guide them past that. This is what we give them when they show up. This contains that description that was also on the directed research guide, so they will get a reminder of what their topic is, and then that summary of the records provided. So you'll see that the records that this student will be looking at are from the 11th Naval District. That naval district was based in San Diego, but also throughout Arizona and California. And they will be looking at records of the district intelligence officer and what the district intelligence officer was responsible for. So this way, we're setting a context for them so it's not so jarring. They're not getting into the records and then being surprised by what they're finding there. They really do kind of have, they know where the records are coming from as they're going into them. Okay? So because I can tell you about this all day long, and I can tell you how great I think it is, and as archivists, we'll all smile at each other and say, that's great, we do great work, and it's true. At the end of the day, our users are K-12 educators and students, and so I really do want to turn this over to Mr. Leibolt from JW North High School. We've been working with him on directed research for his class for 8 years. Quite a while, so he is familiar with this process. We go through it every fall, and it's one of the most remarkable groups over the years that we've worked with, because these are future historians, really, that are coming in and doing original research in our records. And the impact that this process has on them just can't be understated. It's very powerful. They're doing the same thing that David McCullough and Ken Burns and you know, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. do, and they're very excited about that. So I will turn it over to Mr. Leibolt, and he will explain to you how this works for his students.
It's ironic that all my classes are on PowerPoint, but what I brought today, hard copies. Okay. We've been doing this about 8 years, and it's an international baccalaureate class. So it's not just your average group of kids. These are, you know, really focused kids. And the idea of collaborating with the National Archive, they originally were in Laguna Niguel, was quite a project, because it takes a certain amount of money, you know, get the bus, take the kids down there. Getting a sub for the teacher, but it has turned into, I think, the most rewarding educational experience I've ever been involved in. The kids actually, the little notes you saw up there, there are 78 of them, and my class varies from year to year from around 25 to 55 kids. And we literally draw out of a hat to see who gets to select first and on down through the rest of the class. And then you choose a topic that you want. And the kids are then required to find a secondary source that provides background and context information for their projects. For example, I have one here from Cheyenne Franklin. And she wrote about the Mission Indian Federation accusations of repression regards and Bureau of Indian Affairs. This is very heady stuff. Okay, this is a very focused history research paper. And this is exactly what we want them to do. And by having the kids actually put their hands on these archive material, they feel, you know, really involved in a special way. And many of these kids walk away from this project absolutely in awe. They take the secondary source, and they're required to have those. They hand in the books to me about 2 weeks before we go to the archive. And so they're expected to already have a great deal of information before we arrive. And then we arrive, they spend all day going through their archive material. And it's basically an exercise in note-taking. They also get a lot of copies. As you probably know, you usually give students a certain amount of free copies. 1 year, my students got very enthusiastic, and we had a $2,000 copy bill, which we paid for. Okay? My principal, this is back when we had money, so it wasn't as bad as it could have been today. Then the kids have a certain amount of time to use this primary source material with their secondary material to put together these research papers. And it's been such a joy, because I used to do, you know, real traditional kind of research papers, you know, the usual thing, you know, Napoleon, that kind of stuff. But this stuff is so much more exciting because, you know, you not only have the material right in your hands, one-of-a-kind material, but the kids actually get to focus on something that seems so much more real. When you're talking about the Mission-ish Indians rather than Napoleon, this is something that the kids have a much closer relation to. Also, the kids not only feel empowered by this, they walk away from it with this renewed sense of confidence about what their abilities are. My students also, when they go to college, have found that they, in fact, are eligible for some rather remarkable positions. History professors will read their resumes and find out that they actually have archive experience and they will be hired to be a research assistant. I've had, in fact, first-year college students who, in fact, had this opportunity open up to them. So this is an exercise that has wide-ranging applications to students. Thank you.
Before we open up for a discussion, I just wanted to make a few kind of in conclusion remarks. A lot of our presenters kind of touched on the topic of working with teachers, and that really is, you know, a really great way to kind of open yourself up to the K through 12 group, obviously, because, you know, they're teaching them and instructing them on a daily basis. I got a degree in education, and let me tell you, as a new teacher, one of the most difficult things is to find lessons or lesson plans to teach the kids. And so if you as an archivist come in and offer a solution for them, you know, they're really going to appreciate that, and it's something that they're really going to you know, work towards incorporating into their lessons. So just by doing that, you're really doing a favor for them, and it's something that from my experience anyway, teachers are going to kind of be really willing to approach and strongly consider doing. So definitely think about working with the teachers. You could try going to K through 12 classes in your area, or maybe inviting the teachers to come to your institution and kind of give them, you know, an orientation or a tour, let them know sort of what you're doing, what you can do for them. And that'll be a really great way to kind of cement that relationship that you have with teachers in your area. Another thing that especially Deirdre talked about was the excitement that the kids can have. Each year we have a class of fourth graders from a charter school in Laramie, Wyoming, where I work, and they come in, and the first time I did it, I was kind of filled with trepidation because, you know, there were like 30 or 40 fourth graders, and I was going to take them through the stacks, and I was like, you know, oh God, what's going to happen? But they were really well behaved, and they were just so excited to be down there and see, you know, all the giant shelves of boxes, and they were just asking question after question after question, you know, some of them really out of left field, and it was just really invigorating for me on a personal level to see someone that excited in what I was doing, and to, you know, really tell that they were interested in being there and they wanted to be there, and it was just, you know, the most exciting thing that they had done in a long time. So it kind of warms the cockles of your heart a little bit, you know, when you see people who are really interested and excited about what you're doing. So it can be a really great experience, and so it's definitely something that I hope you all consider doing. And now we'll kind of open the floor to questions. Does anyone have a question they would like to answer? Ms. Wagner? Do you want to come up here and answer, Mr. Leibold? So the question was about some standards that are coming up in 2014, sort of if that was an opportunity for archives to kind of work with teachers in order to, an opportunity for archivists to work with teachers sort of along with those standards. Do you want to come up here and? We're a democratic institution.
We are. And I'm on vacation. The National Common Core Standards, if you're not familiar with them, were released about a year and a half ago. All of your states are in the process. Again, four states have adopted out of choosing whether they're going to go with them or not. If you're not familiar with them, you can just do a search at Google on National Common Core Standards. They will come up. Please do not panic when you look at the History Social Science Common Core Standards, because they are not content-driven. They're driven by historical analysis and critical thinking skills. And as the woman who asked the question, and make sure if I get back to that, said, they do present an outstanding opportunity for archivists because they are driven by historical critical thinking. And when you read through there, you can start to see how it's going to link. What has finally happened, although it's taken a while, is that across the nation, the educational community, K-12, have realized that, by gosh, it is possible within an English language arts classroom to focus on expository reading and writing, and often that involves history, social science content. And so what we've got now are Common Core Standards that are focused, again, on historical analysis and critical thinking, and especially the expository reading skills and the writing skills that go along with supporting everything that your panel has talked about. I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, so, I think for the standards, I think it's English and math that are really...
that are very content, very specifically content-driven. For science and history, social science, the National Common Core Standards, again, are focused on historical analysis, well, for history, social science, not science, but historical analysis and the critical reading and writing skills that accompany that, but it is not specifically content-driven. So what you're going to have in your states are your state content standards for history, social science, and then how students will access that content and demonstrate their learning is going to be through the Common Core strategies. So you've got content from your state standards, and for history, social science, the National Common Core Standards for K-12 are going to be how students access that content and then demonstrate how they've learned it.
And I think, too, it's kindergartners.
Yeah, it's definitely a good idea to kind of familiarize yourself with sort of the curriculum standards that teachers in your area might have. For instance, I know in the state of Wyoming, there's definitely an emphasis on Wyoming history, obviously, so... since we know that as an archive, you know, we can use that as a way to encourage teachers to use our materials, because a lot of our materials are related to Wyoming history, so we can kind of make that marriage together. So it's definitely a good idea to kind of familiarize yourself as much as possible with some of the standards in your local schools, and that'll be helpful when you're working with teachers. Yes, ma'am. The question was about using metadata as a way to do a search for ways that it might align with state standards and other curriculum requirements.
So though I'm not directly involved with this, our education department at the National Archives is very aware and gears a lot of what they do towards national standards. Obviously, we're the National Archives. We have the bigger umbrella. So the Docs Teach website that the National Archives has, they do break things up based on those different levels of education, and they do try and make sure that there are materials in there for various standards. And they do, although it's it's all completely fed from our research catalog through online public access and the archival research catalog. So whenever I, as an archivist, put an original image of a document into that catalog, cataloging it the way that we do, they extract that and move it over to DocsTeach and put the educational filter on it so it's got all of the standards and things like that on it on the other side. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Not that I'm familiar with. Leanne Potter with the National Archives would be the one to contact about that. She oversees it. And then Stephanie Greenhut, who obviously also with the National Archives, actually manages DocsTeach, so they would be the person to people to contact about that.
So for the sake of recording, the previous question was about any user studies that had been done about using DocsTeach. Is that okay? Yes, sir. We usually get mugs in Wyoming, seems to be the. Everyone can always use a mug. Yeah, I mean, definitely, like I said, teachers when they first come out of college are, you know, kind of at a loss about, you know, lesson plans and what they're going to teach. So if you can kind of go and see them when they're learning to be teachers and let them know of the resources that you have available, then I think that they'll probably be really appreciative of your efforts. So that's a really great idea to approach education teachers.
Can I
yes, sir.
You back on the
yeah.
Related to that, Rachel's comment back there, session 402 is talking about connecting pre-service teachers with archival institutions to get them this sort of experience. I mentioned that before. But the other great thing about working with teachers who aren't teachers yet is that they'll likely keep using your stuff, okay, because you get them when they're fresh.
I think that we're working on that too. We have been working with two universities for the past 3 years with master's level students and teachers. And they are required to come to our archives and work for at least one day and then do a lesson plan on the objects that they got, the primary source materials. We teach them, we give them a class on primary and secondary sources in their classrooms, and then they come to the archives and work with us. And we've probably dealt with 200 teachers in the last 3 years, and it seems to work very well because every year at the beginning of the fall, we're inundated with questions and comments and requests for materials. So that seems to work too. I think we shouldn't limit it to just the pre-teachers. I think we ought to, you know, work with them in all phases. That's where they work the best, and especially during the summertime. That's when they're off and they can come work with us, and it seems to work pretty good.
Where do you work?
I work at Tuskegee University.
A lot of examples today about National History Day, maybe that 6 through 12 type of engagement. I'm really kind of curious of what's the K through 12. What do you do and how do you engage, say, those younger grades that aren't doing something at the level where you're actually doing a research paper or a research website or something like that?
So the gentleman asked about working with more of the K through 4, K through 5 students. And like I said, at the American Heritage Center, each year we have a class from one of the local charter schools come in, and we have a little project that Greg actually put together during his time at the American Heritage Center. So we have primary sources, photographs from our collections, and we have a series of questions that each group of students has to answer. And so they kind of go through the different photographs, and they look at them, and they answer the questions, and then we kind of share them as a class. And you know, it's really appropriate to their level because, you know, they just kind of have to interpret a photograph and what information they can get from it. And they seem to really enjoy, you know, looking at photographs because, like one of the previous panelists mentioned, if you can approach them at more of like an image or, you know, like a photograph basis, then they seem to be able to connect with that better than, you know, trying to read someone's, you know, scribbling or something like that. So that works really well and looks like...
And I'll kind of add on to that because I did develop that activity and actually took the experience of developing that activity to where I am now. And at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, we actually have a program where we bring in underprivileged K through 5 students and help them to understand college. It's a college experience. It's usually like a week-long thing, and they bring in different groups each and every day. And of course, they want faculty members and instructors to engage with those groups. And so I've been doing that now for 2 years where I'm at, and I see a lot of fifth graders come through the archives during that week. And when it comes to the K through 5 audience, photographs are really one of the best and easiest ways to make those connections. But beyond photographs, maps can also tie into that as well. And somewhat similar to the activity I developed there, I ask them a few age-appropriate questions while looking at a few different stations that I've set up. And I try to tie a story together of each one of those stations, perhaps looking at local history from 100 years ago, 50 years ago, the present history. And for a lot of those kids, it makes a real strong connection because, for example, where I work, one collection that has always kind of stood out is our Uniroyal collection. For those of you who don't know Uniroyal, it was a tire company. And they had a major factory in the Eau Claire area, which after the lumber boom ended, really revitalized the community and kept it going. Well, that factory shut down in the 1990s, but it had so many employees that almost everyone in the community has some connection to it. And for these kids, it's, oh, you know, my grandpa worked there. And so local history really makes those connections, and photographs help to really make it alive.
All right, so we've got about 5 minutes left, and before I forget, there are evaluation forms for the panels at the place where you register, so if you feel inclined, you can go there and fill out one for this panel and other panels that you attend throughout your time here at SAA, so please feel free to do that. All right, well, it looks like we're out of time here, so I want to thank all of you for coming to this panel, and I hope that it was informative and useful, and thank you.